Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast. This is podcast 402, live from the Mobile Podcast Command Unit in my driveway. And I'll tell you why here shortly. In podcast 402, we're going to have a little fun. I'm a little nervous about it. We're going to have a little fun with a concept called pre-fascism in America. And I want to talk about that. I actually wrote this podcast to be podcast 400, and I've had a chance to think about it for a few days, almost a week now, and I've decided I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it a little bit different than how I actually noted it out and wrote it. So we're going to do that in podcast 402, the Bob Davis Podcasts. Well, if you've listened to the Bob Davis Podcasts for any length of time, you know that the Mobile Podcast Command Center, which I'm sitting in my driveway in right now, and there's a reason for that, but I'll tell you in a second. But if you know the podcast, you know that the podcast command vehicle came to me through xgovernmentcars.com. My good friend Ed Johnson, who runs xgovernmentcars.com, has grown the business. I've watched it grow from his driveway to what it is today, which is the largest dealer that I know of for one-owner government and lease vehicles, professionally maintained, and then Ed gets them all ready and gets them out to you. Now, the whole thing about Ed is he's been doing this long enough now that he knows where to get the good ones, the Chargers, the Impalas, the next-gen Fords, plus coming soon, ex-government trucks in Forest Lake, and I'll tell you more about that when we get to the grand opening, but they're going to specialize in ex-government trucks, vans and SUVs. So if you're looking for a work truck, if you're looking for, you know, an Expedition or a Yukon, you can go out and you can spend literally thousands and thousands of dollars to buy one of these vehicles, or you can check out xgovernmentcars.com and see the selection. And then the other big plus and the big piece of why xgovernmentcars.com is so great is they provide financing for all levels of credit, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Everybody is approved, and you can apply safely and securely online right now at xgovernmentcars.com. So let's quickly review. First of all, great financing for all levels of credit. Second, cash deals direct from owner Ed Johnson, and you get a 3-day satisfaction guarantee. So if you don't like the car or the truck for whatever reason, you can take it back and they will do it. The other thing is they have great after the service sale. Ed has helped me immensely with all these vehicles, and they really know what they're doing at xgovernmentcars.com. So check them out. Crown Vicks, the new next-gen Ford SUVs, and the Ford Police sedan, as well as Chargers, Impalas, and trucks, vans, and SUVs, whatever you need, they've got it at xgovernmentcars.com. Let me go up and use the ambulance PA system real quick and give you the bullhorn. I got to climb up into the cockpit. I've got the PA mic. Here we go.
xgovernmentcars.com.
All right, that was cool. Yeah. So I'm in the driveway because the... I did the big trip to Sturgis. We came back from Sturgis, all of the whole package, the equipment, everything's in the truck. And then I knew I was going to turn around and go back up to North Central Wisconsin to see my friend Steve. So I just left everything in the truck. So then I went up to North Central Wisconsin, came back, and it's been in the driveway for a couple of days. And I haven't had the gumption to go out there and pull everything up. Plus, I'm kind of pining away to go somewhere else at the same time, which I'm not going to do. I'm staying here in the cities, and I've got some business things to take care of. And so I'm going to concentrate on that. But I thought I'll just go out and I'll just go ahead and set the studio up in the truck, because when I travel, I break everything down, put everything back in boxes. And then when I get back to the city, I usually just carry everything back in and then break everything down again and build the studio inside. You know, don't even ask me why I do this. Eventually I will have, you know, the same thing in the house as I have in the truck, and I won't have to do that anymore. But so I just left everything in the truck, and I thought tonight I'm just going to come out and do a podcast because I've got everything in the truck. And then what I'll do is I'll just open the back doors and then take everything all fully set up and just carry it inside. So that's kind of the genesis of all this. And I'm really sitting weird. I want to adjust these mics and just move a little bit because my driveway is kind of on an incline, and I'm kind of sitting in a weird position here. And I'm kind of leaning in one direction and I've got the copy stands and everything else in the other direction. And it's just, it's disconcerting. But I got coffee, and coffee is what it's all about. So this podcast is for the people who are super politically involved. It isn't about Donald Trump. It isn't about presidential candidates. It isn't about some inside story about Hillary Clinton's email. It isn't about the day-to-day machinations of the political campaigns. This is just kind of a fun, exercise, a sort of a thought exercise for people as we observe the American political process going into 2016. You guys know that I have been and continue to be, I'm going to say disillusioned with the process. And it isn't burnout. I'm not burned out. I'm super enthusiastic about podcasting. I'm still super enthusiastic to talk about politics. But I don't want to talk about politics the way everyone is talking about politics. And I don't want to continue to just hose down and service what I'm referring to as the bouncing ball, which is look here and pay attention to this and don't pay attention to what's really going on. Now, when I say really going on, I'm not talking about conspiracy theory. I'm talking about real directions in terms of policy and politics that are kind of heading, they seem to me to be heading down a path. Now, I'm not going to say this is where we're headed. I don't want to do that because it's not fun. When I say this is what's going on and start doing pounding on the lectern and saying this is what we have to be aware of and afraid of, it ruins the fun. And I'm not going to talk about it that way anymore. In fact, I haven't talked about it that way in a long time. But I told you and I pledged to you podcast listeners that I would do my best to really kind of search my thoughts and try to think, I don't want to say out of the box because that's such a cliche, but try to think about what I'm thinking about and then bring that out in the podcast. And let me tell you, it's hard. It would be much easier for me to sit here for 20 minutes and talk about Hillary Clinton's email scandal. It would be much easier for me to sit here and do a podcast on the Chinese economic situation and what it means. And I might do that anyway. But in other words, it would be much easier for me to take stories out of the news and comment on them. Or, you know, go to some village board meeting somewhere and record that, which actually is a good idea. But what I'm trying to do is share with you in an authentic, there's another cliche, but in a real way what I'm thinking about. Because I'm sure I'm not the only person thinking this stuff. So I invite the feedback, of course, as always. But I want to do this in a fun way because it's not necessarily a fun topic. Now, most of the time when you throw out words like fascist or fascistic, people sit up and take notice. They hear that word and it's like a dirty word. And they expect the next thing out of your mouth is going to be a Hitler reference or a comparison of the current administration to the doomed German Chancellor of Germany, Adolf Hitler, back in the 1930s through World War II. That's not really what I'm trying to do in this podcast. And that's not really the intent of this discussion. Certainly the most famous fascism is German fascism, dating from the collapse of the Weimar Republic to May of 1945. And if you're going to make any kind of comparison to fascism without qualification to the American political landscape, you're going to get people who are going to tut, tut, tut and tell you that the U.S. economic situation doesn't compare to Germany's and tell you that you're being an alarmist and so forth. That's why I want to do this in a fun thought exercise kind of way. What I've learned is that at its root, all fascism is the marshaling of all the country's resources for a single nationalistic goal. Now, some dictionaries define fascism as right-wing and radical, which I believe is incorrect. Here is actually a good definition of fascism from the dictionary.com app on my iPhone. A governmental system led by a dictator having complete power, forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism, regimenting all industry, commerce, and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism and often racism. I think that's pretty good. I would take out some of the other more incendiary language and just simply say that fascism is a dictator who marshals the resources of the country for a single nationalistic goal. That at its root is fascism. And I do get hung up on the definitions of words, and I do get hung up on how dictionaries define political concepts. I think they're probably really hard to define when you're looking at the academic world, because there are so many things that people associate with fascism, especially German fascism, because of what happened in World War II. If you want to examine it further, a further examination of the politics of fascism tells you that it is a form of radical national authoritarian nationalism that actually originated in Italy as a movement in opposition to liberalism, and not the kind of liberalism that we talk about here in the United States. It's not what the talk radio guys talk about when they say, these liberals like Hillary Clinton. We're talking about classic liberalism, which is democratic and stands for liberty and equality, the kind of liberalism that founded the United States of America. It is an opposition to that kind of liberalism, Marxism and anarchism. And if you read your Hayek, you know that he believed that the wellspring of fascism in Europe was the failure of socialist governments to function effectively, both economically and as stewards of the people's trust. What these governments did do was amass power in a central government first. And then when the pluralistic or democratic socialist governments collapsed, even center-left weak democracies, in the case of the Weimar Republic, left consolidated power at the disposal of a dictator to enact total control of industry, military, and politics, and thus the people. You often hear people say, how could that have happened in Germany? And it's because the legal mechanisms were created and the Constitution was weakened to the extent that someone, a demagogue, let's say, or a dictator, literally a person that would become the dictator, was able to ignore them. I mean, it's true in much the same way that the Caesars, you know, that the what was originally designed as a short-term executive in Rome eventually morphed into a dictator, because eventually the idea of a constitution, not that Rome actually had a constitution, but the idea of whatever constituted the republic to begin with kind of just faded, and you were left with a position where someone could amass power. It's important, though, not to give the impression that these dictators seized power in some extra legal way. That happened later. They were elected to office, and it could even be argued that in Rome, Caesar, who is the Rosetta Stone for all dictators, was someone who was celebrated by the people and by the Senate and by the top families of Rome at the time. So these movements were political, and not only were the leaders elected, there were a number of people elected to the legislatures to support them. So they had support, political support in the country, right? Well, now it started to rain. And it's really cool because now you can actually hear the rain on the roof of the Mobile Podcast Command Center. So what I'm interested in this is, as a thought exercise, is the political atmosphere in the places that have adapted or adopted or elected fascistic leaders, whether it was Italy or Japan or Germany or Latin America in the 50s and 60s. And I'm sure there's other places as well. And the reason I'm interested in this is, I think as a thought exercise, we could suggest, and I'm not even going to say it is. I'm not even going to say that I think it is, because I don't know. But I think, especially now with what I'm seeing on television and what I'm seeing in the media about this primary campaign, what if we are in something called, and I'm naming this, I don't know if this exists, I'm going to name it though, a pre-fascistic stage. That is, we seem to have a lot of factions in both of the mainline political parties that won't work with or even break with other factions completely. And we seem to have a lot of rhetorical solutions to problems, which may or may not be acute depending on who you talk to. And in my view, a pre-fascistic stage can be reversed. It doesn't mean we're headed to American fascism dead ahead. It just means the political atmosphere feels uncontrollable, rhetorical, angry, and confused. And at the same time, all of the candidates seem to be talking about making the central government stronger. And it doesn't seem to matter whether they're Republicans or Democrats. And I'll give you three examples. There's a story today about Hillary Clinton talking to meeting with the Black Lives Matter people so that they don't disrupt her speeches. They were kept out of a speech that she was supposedly giving. And then there's a video that they did with her meeting with Black Lives Matter. And it doesn't matter what the position of Black Lives Matter is. What matters is that she was saying to them, you know, we need to develop policy solutions to the problems that you're talking about. And it's clear that in her eyes and in the eyes of a lot of Democrats, the solution to any problem is more government programs, and we need to help people get better houses and better education and things of that nature. I'm not passing judgment. I'm just saying that is, you know, almost a by rote position of almost all Democrat candidates, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or Barack Obama or Franklin Roosevelt. And I mean, it almost goes without saying that Black Lives Matter weren't too happy with what she said, because they wanted to see that there had been a shift in her feeling. And I don't want to get into the topic because it's not worth talking about, but it was the things that she was talking about that struck me. That's one example. The second example was Donald Trump is saying he has released his plan to deal with immigration, which people are saying, well, this is actually pretty substantive, and this is very interesting what he's actually proposing. One of the things that he proposes is to have the government tell companies that they have to pay H-1B visa holders more so that American workers will be somehow equalized in pay. Now, here's another example of this guy is running as a Republican candidate, but he wants to use the government to intervene to solve a problem. Okay. And that would mean an extension of power of the government, because now the government's going to tell businesses what they can pay H-1B visa holders these days. And the third example is here we have Jeb Bush, who just said today that he believes we have to enhance and improve the powers of the NSA so that we can track down and stop, quote unquote, evildoers. So there you have three candidates really from a different spectrum in American politics, and all three of them are talking about expanding the power of the government. That's what I mean by uncontrollable or confused or angry or even rhetorical speaking and statements and so forth from political candidates as well as from the rank and file. Had lunch with a friend of mine today, and we were talking about the frustration that people feel, and yet they don't want to work. This one doesn't want to work with that one. These people don't agree with those people, and that's true in both parties. Some people in this country blame the political system and the politicians themselves. Some say that we have an elite class of people running the country who don't pay attention to the people. Some say the United States is rapidly becoming an oligarchy, which is a state in which the financial resources are controlled by a few wealthy families. Almost all of the blaming does not mention the electorate or how we got into this state in the first place. So, and I'm going to give you a little background on that, even though it will take a little bit longer. But one of the reasons that money is collecting at the top is because the Federal Reserve keeps trying to reinflate the banking system, and that's getting reinvested in the stock market. And so the people closest to the money printing, in this case, are the ones that are benefiting. That's part of the reason for the inequality. The other part of the reason for the inequality is we have a very slow or moribund growth in this country. And when that happens, the people who are richest just are able to maintain and grow their resources, and it creates this crust where small companies can't grow into medium-sized companies, and medium-sized companies can't grow into large companies. And if you're in business, I'm sure you're experiencing this, where you know you go for a couple of quarters, you make hay while the sun shines, because you know that you're going to have a couple of quarters that it's just going to be really, really slow, because we're not seeing dynamic growth. And I've talked about that in other podcasts. What I think is happening is that the federal government, which was created from the beginning to knit together 13 colonies to defend and protect the rights of the citizens and to defend the country as a whole, has now become so large and so extensive in this country that we cannot do the things it cannot. I shouldn't say we, but I should say that it cannot do the things it was commissioned, constituted to do very well anymore. It doesn't really protect our rights at the very least. And I think thus there is dissatisfaction with government throughout the political spectrum because it's too powerful, it's too big, it's too responsible for too many things, from, you know, the design of the roundabouts off the freeway to the bike trails to the government aid programs to state health care programs. And I could go on and on and on. We did not get here in the Obama administration alone. We have been here or close to here for many decades in this country. Personally, I believe that the growth of the central government, which the founders would not recognize today, dates back to the Civil War when Abraham Lincoln, perhaps justifiably, pushed the limits of presidential constitutional power to do what he thought was necessary to preserve and protect the Union. From there, Wilson expanded the power of the federal government in World War I, and of course, Roosevelt pushed the limits of constitutional executive power to do things people wanted, like win the war and ameliorate the economic stress of the Depression and everything, because people freaked out. And by the way, many of the programs that Roosevelt continued were, of course, put in place by a technocrat by the name of Herbert Hoover, who was a Republican, and really completely different from the classic liberal President Coolidge, for example. And of course, presidents and congresses have added to the power of the federal government significantly all through the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, and the 2000s, even Ronald Reagan. New studies suggest a lot of what these leaders did was misguided, sometimes terribly misguided, especially economically. But they did it, and they did it because politically people were demanding that something be done. And that's really what matters here, because this has brought us to where we are today. Some do not trust the federal government. Some do not trust local governments. Some do not trust the executive departments of the federal government. Some live outside the law in all sorts of areas, in all sorts of ways. Some people are in open conflict with the government, and not always on the cattle farms in Nevada, but in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, and for completely different reasons today. The socialist complains about Wall Street, and so does the extreme right-wing anti-government oath keeper. The socialist complains about inequality and worries about China taking all the jobs in the U.S., and so do a lot of Tea Party adherents. If you can pull yourself up from getting emotionally engaged in the arguments, remember following the bouncing ball, you can hear both sides of the political spectrum really saying the same things. They are shouting and screaming and pounding and demanding and telling and ordering and refusing and protesting and drawing a line in the sand, albeit at different points in the political spectrum over whatever they're upset about, albeit rhetorically currently, whatever they're frustrated or angry about. We're about this close to some of these movements becoming street movements, which is what, you know, these radical political movements get promulgated on. This is a far cry from a country that came out of the Depression and World War II with a sense of having to work together. I've talked about that in other podcasts, too. And I would suggest to you, if you think that it was easy for them to work together, you're crazy. If you think that they all agreed with the existing powers idea of how things should be, you're crazy. If I heard it's all Roosevelt's fault once in my family growing up, I heard it 100 times. And yeah, there were a number of issues in the late 40s through the 1960s that challenged people's spirit of working together. But how do those eras compare to today in terms of the people that really were running the country, and how do the leaders of that era compare to today? Now, it would be very easy for me to blame our ills on the elite and the political leadership in Washington. In fact, people do it all the time, because cronyism and corruption is present in the district and all our governments, as it always has been and always will be. You can go back to any point in U.S. history, and you're going to find cronyism, you're going to find gross corruption, and you're going to find efforts in the government to do something about it, and you're going to find the people responding to doing something about it. The point is that there is a mechanism to address those things, and that it remains vibrant, and it remains a supple and well-watered tree, because there's always going to be corruption. The difference today, I think, is that governments are so much more powerful now, and corruption, therefore, can do a lot of damage and upset a lot of people very quickly, and then that creates these movements. And then I think, well, who do you blame? If you really want to blame someone, I have to say, I don't blame the government. I blame the voters. I blame people. I travel the country, as you know, in this vehicle. And while there are some economic problems that need to be addressed, and I've talked about them, there are two things that I think need to be said right now. First of all, people, I think, need to learn that we need to think of the economy as a force of nature, like a big hurricane or a summer tornado, right, or an earthquake. The U.S. economy is a massive system made possible by millions of people doing all kinds of different things. And I think in general, whether it is workers, business owners, or the wealthy, this is a pretty innovative and resilient people. And if you want the economy to grow, you've got to release the innovation. And the people will do the work. And this is a different way of thinking about the economy than people who are, let's say, socialist or, you know, for lack of a better term, let's just say statist, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. They think that they have to do something, that the government has to do something. We will do the work if they will get out of the way. Second, you cannot demand that solutions be simply rhetorical. I did a podcast about that where I talked about the complexities of some of the problems that we're dealing with in this country. For example, close the borders is not a solution. We can close the borders, but it's going to produce other kinds of reactions, which will then be bigger problems. Fix the economy will not fix it. Make America great again will not make it great again, and so on. They're not telling you what they would do. And then when you actually hear them tell you what they would do, oddly enough, it involves creating yet more government power. There are two things I've observed in the last year. First of all, there are a lot of angry and frustrated people. I've said that many times. And they, most of them have no idea how to actually get in there and solve the problems that they claim we have. When you talk to somebody who has done that, even if they start out as a radical right or left person, they end up being a lot more reasonable because they actually have solved problems within government and they realize how difficult it is because you don't get to be a dictator. We don't want a dictator. And this is the essence of this thought experiment of pre-fascism. Or do we? I mean, it seems like we just want somebody to solve the problem and we don't want to know how it gets solved. We just want it to be solved. And then as if that would solve the problem, right? Most of these angry and frustrated people are in different factions of the political tribe, whether it is a religion, constitutionalists, whatever that is, because while many of them claim to be constitutional scholars, they really aren't, authorities on police brutality, conspiracy theorists, anarchists, socialists, and so forth. None of them will work with the other factions that purport to have the same level of authority on the same side even of the spectrum as they are, and that's the breakdown in the political system. Many aren't even involved in politics. They're just upset, and then they think going to a meeting, as I've discussed, is political work, but that's not real political work. Many of them seem to be directors of their own personal political movement or part of a motley collection of other like-minded birds of a feather who use social media and other digital tools to magnify themselves and seem more powerful than they actually are. Or they are part of organizations that wealthy groups have stood up to capture this group of people. But here's the key. They're not part of the political process. They're not going to their local political meetings. They're not being part of their political party. They're doing something over here. And whether or not that thing over here has a political impact is hard to tell. And it's true on the right and the left. And many of their solutions, when you get right down to it, are nothing more than memes or t-shirts. Both sides say the government doesn't listen to them and doesn't do what they want. But they all want different things. They're in many cases diametrically opposed to each other. So whether it is Huey Long or Bernie Sanders or a Donald Trump or Douglas MacArthur or a player yet to be named, the so-called pundits will say things like, I don't like so-and-so, but I like what he says. What does that mean? And I don't like hearing that because I've tried to point out to people in the political realm that nothing gets done without working with each other. This is what people don't understand about previous generations. People worked together in political movements to solve problems. We're not doing that. Aside from the usual tired refrain of some of us have to work, and we hear it all the time, the response is revolutionaries become part of the problem because they compromise and the solutions to our problems are not in politics. Well, where are they then? You see what I'm saying about pre-fascism? In other words, the beachhead being sort of softened up for this pre-fascistic idea that our solutions aren't going to be in politics. Therefore, I don't know how to fill that blank in. Here you have the anarchist contingent of American politics, meaning we're not going to have anything to do with politics. And I believe, or I would like to suggest the idea that we're in this sort of pre-fascist state right now, because the only people actually participating in government are being pilloried as the so-called elite. But I don't see anyone really stepping up to help run things, because it takes experience. You have to have some experience to run things. I don't care whether it's a business. I don't care whether it's a radio station or the McDonald's. You don't walk in and start running the McDonald's. You have to learn the job. So that's one of the things that I think leads to this sort of pre-fascistic stage. All I hear about are complaints and demands. It's complaints and demands. People being shouted off stages, or name-calling, or snarking out on somebody else because of their point of view, or saying F you, or, you know, so-and-so's an ass. And these aren't arguments. These are just angry people. And all of this anger and frustration is really fuel for a potential movement where a guy comes along and just says the things that these people gravitate to. And in all of these factions, there is a yearning for this personality, this person outside themselves who can just win the argument and make it all stop, who can just finish it off, get the last word. And I don't hear much talk from any of the candidates in any part of the spectrum about actually reducing the size of the government's power and cutting. The antidote to fascism is the reduction of the government's power so that they can't take over, so that they can't surveil you, so that they can't move into the block and lock everybody in their houses and not let them out, so that they can't bring the SWAT team in, so that they can't abuse citizens who might be poor. If you remove the power of the government to do that, they can't do that. But I don't hear these guys talking about doing that. When I see Donald Trump, who right now is the big, you know, rhetorical candidate, and his solution, one of his solutions to the immigration problem, is to force companies to pay certain people more money to, quote unquote, equalize the pay. That is hardly a libertarian solution. And that is not a solution that militates for smaller government or less powerful government. I don't like to say smaller. I like to say less powerful. And then on the other side of the coin, the left just wants to take money away from the rich. And the right wants to use the power of the government to make people act a certain way, just like I demonstrated with Trump, or as I am demonstrating with Jeb Bush, saying things like we need to increase the power of the surveillance state to stop the evildoers wherever they are. See what I'm saying? It's a scapegoating, and that's another little sign. And at the bottom of all this is a lot of anger and fear. People don't know enough about issues to actually discuss them. Sometimes you can't discuss them because people get angry. And one of the things I like to try to do is not get angry and try to work people through the anger to actually have a conversation about a particular issue. You just get so-and-so is an asshole, and that's the end of the conversation. And if you say that's not an argument, they just repeat it. Disrespect seems to be the order of the day, and it's not limited to young millennial protesters in places like Ferguson that I've seen and heard. It's also among adults who are in advanced age who should know better, to tell you the truth. And yet we want someone to come along and solve some of the most complex problems the world has ever seen, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it is fixing this economy, whether it is closing the borders, redistributing the wealth, creating an equitable health insurance system that actually works, reformulating a taxation policy that's fair and works and gets out of people's lives, defending the nation against these asymmetric threats, educating your children or helping you educate your children, managing the transportation system for commerce in addition to individuals, regulating potentially dangerous industries, but not too much, and reducing the power of the government without creating chaos, since for the past 70 years, the people of this country have been living with an intrusive government. If we went back to the government that we had in 1830, I'm not sure people in this country could handle it. I'm not sure that we're resourceful enough to be able to handle it. And so it's going to have, there's a weaning process that has to take place, and you have to have people that understand where to pull the plug on policy to actually make it work. Somebody asked me today, what do you do about this, that, and the other thing? I think it was something to do with light rail. And I said, you've got to address, you've got to A, figure out a way to divide and conquer, and B, you've got to find the stake to drive through the heart of the funding for things like light rail if you don't want light rail. And in this case, you have to encourage NIMBYism because that's what delays it while you figure out how to pull the plug and to get support for pulling the plug, for example. That's just one example. It's not, you can't just tear the train out and pull up the tracks and say it's over with. You know, you'd have to be a dictator to do that. And yet people want that. They say they want that. But miraculously, somehow, someone's going to come along, right? And they're going to call a television personality a name, or they're going to say something cheeky and snarky, or they're going to say something that makes people feel good. And suddenly that person is the one. And yet there we sit, in our chairs or in the back of the work or at the bar, smoking and bitching and moaning, just wishing someone would come along to solve all of the problems that we have. And the fact is that someone will. The man on the horse, the man who will make the trains run on time, the man who will make the world respect us again, or the woman, the man who will show you how to respect yourself again. And this man or woman will be able to assume the presidency at a time when an enormous amount of legal power has been vested in it. And if this personality is popular enough, Congress will be happy to let him or her exercise that power and take the fall unless he or she doesn't and we take the fall. And this is what happens in fascistic governments. Eventually, the executive assembles and amasses all the power, and you get someone who really knows how to work it, who's smart enough to pull those things together, not to reduce the power of government, which would be the right thing, the patriotic thing to do, but to make themselves a dictator. And whose fault will it be? It will be our fault, because we have put him or her in there because we didn't necessarily agree with him, but we liked what he said. We wanted easy solutions to complex problems. We wanted a show. We wanted a three-ring circus. And it won't matter whether you're a conservative or Christian or socialist. It won't matter whether you're an anarchist who has given up on politics or a moderate in the leadership, because you will be pushed to accept this center-right or center-left movement to make the trains run on time that will eventually amass all of the power of the state to marshal all of the U.S. resources to one national goal. And so, you know, the definition of fascism is not necessarily so visible in the pre-fascistic stage, and by the time it's visible, it's too late. Now, you might say something like, I don't like so-and-so, but I'm glad that someone is saying this stuff. And that's exactly what, to me, that is the beginning of accepting tyranny. Now, can we have friendly fascism in this country? I suppose we can. Some people believe that Roosevelt was a fascist. Can we be a socialist country? I was thinking about this the other day. Yeah, we could be socialist. The United States could be socialist. It won't be the same, but we could be socialist. And we can continue down that path for a number of years, maybe decades. But sooner or later, we or our children or their children will find out what the loss of freedom actually means. And they may grow up not even knowing what freedom is. I often talk about the people in China. They don't have a recourse if the economy goes bad. They don't have a legal recourse because they have no voice. They don't have freedom, their God-given, unalienable right to be who they are, to be an individual, has never been granted to them by a government that is a tyranny in China. And yet you have people in the United States pointing to China and saying, that's what we should be like. Here's the thing. Rhetoric does not solve problems. Rhetoric does not lead revolutions. Rhetoric alone does not win wars or make history. You certainly need it. It serves a purpose. But people have to work together to win. You know, I've often talked a lot about World War II and how we didn't think we were going to win World War II. There, in 1943 and 44, we almost lost a couple of times. And if you read enough World War II history, you'll know that. It's also true that we almost didn't win the Union anyway, didn't win the Civil War more than once. And I've often talked about how our founders were, in fact, people who would consider, we would actually consider the founders today to be elites. They were people who had been entrusted with a lot of responsibility in their home colonies long before the war, during the war, and afterwards. I've often compared some of these guys to the Bill Gates and the Steven Jobs of their generations. They were young. Benjamin Franklin was in his 50s only at the time of the Revolution, and most of them were in their 30s and some in their 20s. We talk a lot about, but Andrew Jackson as a soldier in the Revolutionary War was a child. So a lot of those people were really, really young, and they knew what they were doing and why they were doing what they were doing. They understood why they were doing it, and they could make the arguments for why they were doing what they were doing. And they could make the arguments as complex or as simple as the audience needed. They also knew how to compromise and what to compromise on, and they knew they were leaving some problems on the table that would have to be solved going forward because they couldn't solve them at the Constitutional Convention. Slavery, for example. So they weren't perfect, but they got it done, and they hoped that successive generations would be as virtuous as they were when it came to these issues. Given the present electorate, I highly doubt that we could do what they did today. And that is actually the problem in this country. What I do think we could do is say hello to the man on the horse, because given what I see in the present time frame, including the political sphere, the coverage of this political sphere, the things people are saying, I think that's what you're about to get. I don't know when we're going to get it. I don't know if it's going to be this election or the next election or other elections. I'm going to continue to work on this theme a little bit. But I think that unless people wake up and start actually working together in the political process, which actually tempers you as a human being and makes you a better human being and helps you as a problem solver in the rest of the world, because you find out that just because you think something's a good idea doesn't make it a good idea. That's what compromise is to a certain extent. It's not giving up your principles, but it's figuring out a way to work with other people to make these things happen that need to happen. And I'm not saying compromise is the watchword of all this. I'm not saying that. I mean, our founders didn't compromise. They were uncompromising in the sense that they believed in certain rights and things like that. But among the people that formed the Republic, there was disagreement. Let's face it. Slavery is a perfect example of that disagreement going back to the foundation of the country. So if we don't learn to work together, if we don't learn to get involved in the government, not in some alphabet group that has been put together by a rich guy somewhere for their purposes, but in our government, then I don't know. I think it's only a matter of time before we get an oppressive government that assumes all the powers that have been granted to it through executive orders, and many of them unconstitutional, through poor legislation from Congress, and by cowards, people who serve because they want to be important and who really are cowards in our government, who will allow this to happen. And the backstop is the people. But we don't seem to be in a mood to do anything about it. Got to thank xgovernmentcars.com for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast 402. Don't forget, they have nicer, newer vehicles now at xgovernmentcars.com. Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, trucks, vans, and SUVs. Coming soon, xgovernment trucks. The main thing is the financing. It's great. All levels of credit, the good, the bad, the ugly, everybody gets approved. Plus cash deals direct from Ed Johnson, the owner. You get a 3-day satisfaction guarantee. I mentioned financing. You can apply online safely and securely 24/7 at xgovernmentcars.com. Let's do the bullhorn one more time.
xgovernmentcars.com.
Thanks to the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis Podcast.com, Alpha Systems. If you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Click on the Alpha Systems banner for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. Had lunch with the founder of Alpha Systems today, and he told me a little bit about the genesis of the system, and very quickly, I'll just tell you, he asked people recently, have you ever done anything stupid in an airplane? And a lot of people raised their hand. And he said, the reason I'm so passionate about Alpha Systems is I did something stupid in an airplane once, and I fell from the sky. And if you get the chance, maybe you can talk to Mark Korn about it, and he'll tell you all about the genesis and the idea behind Alpha Systems. It is truly a life-saving revolution. It's now FAA approved. So click on the banner for more information. And thank you guys for listening on Stitcher. Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn. I'm hearing great things about Stitcher recently, that it is very quick and that it gets the podcast faster than iTunes. I love iTunes, but if you're having problems and you have an Android device, get Stitcher.com. All you got to do is just download the app at Stitcher.com and it will hook you up. TuneIn, BlogTalkRadio.com, iTunes, and right on the page at TheBobDavisPodcast.com. Thank you for liking, sharing, favoriting, following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And thanks for your donations at TheBobDavisPodcast.com. I got a donation of $150 from the general manager of The Bob Davis Podcast today. And it came through snail mail because she couldn't figure out how to get PayPal to work. But thank you, Mom. That was great. And thanks for your donations. They're loading me up for diesel fuel for the next foray by the mobile podcast command unit, and I can't wait. I don't know what it's going to be. I'm going to be in town for a while, but we will head out again, and thank you for listening and everything else to the Bob Davis Podcast's Podcast 402.